Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Find out about new shows, featured guests, and what's up this week. Find us on Facebook by searching keyword Voice America.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Drug addiction continues to be a problem in this country and other parts of the world. The amazing fact is that you may not know that you're living with an addiction problem and that the drugs in question may be in your own home. This is Afflicted by Addiction with your host, Bradley DeHaven. Brad has been on the front lines of addiction and will share the wisdom he's discovered along with guest experts and those who have lived through it or are living through it right now. Here's your host, Bradley DeHaven.
Good morning. My name is Bradley DeHaven, and I'm your host on Afflicted by Addiction. You can reach me at the website rxdrugaddict.com, and today we have a wonderful host that will be joining us shortly. I've written two books on addiction, Defining Moments, which chronicles my journey into my son's addiction as I went undercover to save him from a prison stint and get him into rehab for professional help. My second book, The Addict Among Us, which formal title is How to Prevent, Detect, Treat, and Live with the Addict Among Us, is my work as I've interviewed parents after going on the speaking circuit and speaking about my first book. I found that there were a lot of commonalities and a lot of common things that we did on how to prevent, detect, treat, and live with the addict in our life. So I shared that in the book, and I share other people's story. Today, we are joined by Dr. Andrew Kolodny, probably the leading expert on opiate addiction in the United States, at least in my opinion, and I think in a lot of people's opinion that I deal with. I first met Dr. Kolodny in Washington, D.C. at a hearing for a drug called by a drug company called Zogenix, called Zohydro, and we'll talk a little bit about that during our interview. But to tell you a little bit about Dr. Andrew Kolodny is I could probably spend the whole show on his bio, but we'll go into asking him some questions. But he's the chair of psychiatry at Maimonides, which I'm having a problem pronouncing, but Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. He's also board certified in psychiatry and addiction medicine. Again, he's a national expert on opiate addiction and the epidemic. President of Physicians for Responsible Opiate Prescribing, which is called PROP, and was previously the medical director for special projects of the Office of the Executive Director Commissioner for New York City. And without any further ado, I would like to bring in and welcome Dr. Andrew Kolodny.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you're most welcome, and thanks for taking the time out of your very busy schedule. You've been a tough one to tackle and find an hour with, and I really appreciate it. I know that you're very busy all over the United States and speaking and making a difference in this epidemic, so we appreciate that.
Thank you.
So without, you know, one of the things I ask all of my guests is a very simple question with probably a complex answer, and it'll be interesting to ask it to you because a lot of times I interview parent activists all over the United States or politicians that were motivated to get into a little bit more about addiction and learn about addiction because of personal experience in a lot of cases. But in yours, I'll ask you the question, Dr. Kolodny, are you afflicted by addiction?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think that there's anyone who lives in the United States who could really answer that question and honestly and say no. I think everybody is afflicted by addiction, either personally or with someone in their family. I think very few people don't have at least one relative who has struggled with addiction, and certainly people have friends and family. But our communities and are afflicted by addiction, and the United States right now is struggling very much with a severe drug epidemic, perhaps the worst drug epidemic in United States history, at least according to the CDC. So certainly I would say that I am afflicted by addiction.
So in the United States, knowing what you just said, and I feel exactly the same way, that everybody is at some level afflicted by addiction, whether it's themselves, a family member, a friend, the neighbor, or going to the funeral of a young child that their kid grew up with. I mean, it just hits home with so many people. So why is it that we as a country don't hear that much about this epidemic on the evening news?
Yeah, I think that one of the problems is the stigma of addiction, so that there are many people who are losing loved ones to drug overdose deaths. And, you know, not everyone who dies of a drug overdose has the disease of addiction. Among the people who are dying of drug overdoses, you have young adults who may be experimenting for the first time with an opioid that's very strong. They have no tolerance and they die of an overdose. And you may have the occasional pain patient who forgets that they already took their 80 milligram OxyContin, takes a second one, and then doesn't wake up in the morning. But the bulk of the people who appear to be dying of drug overdose deaths seem to have the disease of addiction. And when somebody loses a loved one to a drug overdose, there's a tremendous amount of shame associated with that and stigma. If it's grandma that died of the drug overdose, people don't want, you know, you may not want the grandkids to know that it was an overdose. So people are suffering quietly when they lose loved ones to this disease because of the stigma. Perhaps they're worried that that their friends may think that they themselves are suffering, that addiction runs in their family. So people keep very quiet about it when they lose someone they love. Unlike other diseases, where when we lose loved ones, people may be more comfortable speaking out about it or sharing their loss with others.
I agree. It's definitely something that we stay behind our picket fence and try to act like it didn't happen. And in some cases, people do step forward. And you and I both know so many of those people that step forward and go public with their pain to help others not experience the same pain, the stigma, the shame. They kind of put that aside so that they can march forward and hopefully keep another family from something worse than stigma and shame. And that's burying a child or a loved one or a grandmother or anybody.
Right. I'd have to say I'm very impressed by the courage that many individuals have shown who do lose a loved one and want to prevent the loss or the pain that they've felt. They want to prevent others from feeling that or experiencing it, and they do come forward and they begin advocacy organizations, and many of them devote their lives to fighting this problem. And I can, just to name a few, Pete Jackson from ARPO, or Avi Israel from Save the Michaels, or Kathy Creedon, or April Rivero, and I could go on and on. People who've lost loved ones and speak out publicly about losing loved ones to either addiction or to an accidental overdose.
Right, and I'm humbled by working with those people too. You just mentioned four incredible people. In the last 48 hours, I've talked to three out of four of those four people that you just mentioned. So they definitely are movers and shakers. In fact, on this very day, the airing of this show, Tuesday, July 2nd, we will be at the California State Capitol trying to get the Cures Bill passed, which is very much like the I-STOP bill that you passed in New York City. So, and April Rivero is a major player in that, and really, after burying her son Joey, has become an advocate that is a force to be reckoned with. So let me ask you something about yourself. You're a national expert on opiate addiction. So many of us out there that are the parents in the street, are the dads that, well, you know, I told you my story briefly as I went undercover for my son. I found myself thrown into this world, not intentionally, much like Avi or Kathy or April or, you know, Pete, that it calls to you. But in your case, what called to you? What brought you into this? And what did you need to do to become so well-educated on addiction?
You know, so I went to medical school and with an interest in working in the field of public health, but chose to do a psychiatry residency program. And in psychiatry, there is a specialty within psychiatry that focuses on addiction. But I didn't have any... I kind of liked all parts of psychiatry and wanted to go into public health. Didn't realize that I would ultimately devote my career to addiction. It was after residency I took my first job with New York City's health department, and we had a brand new health commissioner at the time who was eager to tackle a problem that hadn't been getting enough attention in New York City, which were drug overdose deaths. And this was the early 2000s, and it was a time when drug overdose deaths were almost synonymous with deaths from heroin or from cocaine. And so I was given the assignment, working for the health department, to try and reduce the number of people dying of drug overdoses. And we came up with some neat interventions, for example, seeing that heroin users would have access to naloxone or Narcan to be able to rescue peers when they witnessed an overdose. And we also worked on expanding access to treatment to prevent people from dying of overdoses. And while we were making some significant successes in reducing heroin overdose deaths in certain communities that had been plagued with heroin for 40 years, these were New York City's highest need neighborhoods. They were where the poorest New Yorkers lived, people who were more likely to be minorities. They were the neighborhoods hit hard with heroin in the 1970s. We were making significant achievements in reducing overdose deaths in those populations, in those neighborhoods. But while we were succeeding in that area and among that group, we were sort of beginning to recognize that we had a very new problem that was beginning to get very serious, and it was affecting neighborhoods and communities that had not previously been hit so hard with opioid addiction, and this was the pain pill problem. And certainly by the mid-2000s, it was very clear that we had many people who were losing their lives from painkiller overdose deaths. And I guess I've since left working for the health department, but in many ways I've stayed. I'm continuing on that first assignment to reduce drug overdose deaths.
So when we look at drug overdose, and when most people think about drug addiction and overdose, they do think of it as what you originally described as this, big city, New York, maybe a lower income, tight little area, heroin addiction and things like that. But now, suburban affluent families are uttering those words to me, and I know they're uttering them to you and a lot of other people, and that's that my child is a heroin addict. And here they live in a big house on the hill, they've done everything they can, they coach their kids' soccer team, they don't understand that heroin has infiltrated their suburban shell of a life. So can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Well, we're seeing heroin in parts of the country that have never had heroin problems before, and the reason that we're seeing heroin is that there's been a dramatic increase over a short period of time in the number of people who have developed the disease of opioid addiction. And when you have a sharp increase in the prevalence of a disease in a short period of time, that is what you would call an epidemic. And so we have this sharp increase in people who've become opioid addicted through exposure to painkillers. And now that you've got this market of people who are addicted, you have businessmen, or criminals maybe is a better term, who are taking advantage of the fact that they have a market. And so they're bringing heroin into communities that haven't had it. And for people who are opioid addicted, transition to heroin can often be very cost effective. So, for example, if you're a young adult paying $25 for a 30 milligram oxycodone pill, they call them Roxys on Staten Island, or they also call them Perc 30s. That can be very expensive. So, whereas a bag of heroin will cost much less and sometimes go further. So you have people who transition because it's more cost effective to use heroin than to use pills, and it's and often that transition to heroin will mark a transition to injection use as well, which is what's so concerning about this change to heroin. Although there are plenty of people who are also injecting pills,
right? And so this transition, if you will, is somewhat natural when the medicine cabinets are empty in their suburban home or their grandparents' or their friends' or neighbors' homes, or they can no longer harvest, which is a term that drug addicts use. My son is a recovering drug addict. That when they can no longer harvest other adults who are willing to go fill those prescriptions and resell them, then they do naturally turn to the drug that owns them, which is, you know, the best, next best thing to feed their habit is heroin.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I think sometimes when you hear discussions about that new heroin problem, I think there are many in the public who will have this perception that someone is switching to a harder drug when they go from a pain pill to heroin. The reality is heroin is not a harder drug than oxycodone. They really are in many ways almost the exact same drug. In fact, there was an interesting study done at Columbia University several years ago where a researcher who had permission from the DEA to do research with heroin brought people who were addicted to heroin into her laboratory and allowed them to self-administer by injection either heroin or oxycodone or morphine or fentanyl. They were able to take different opioids, and they tried to see that people would inject equivalent doses. And without knowing what drug they were taking, sort of kind of like a blind taste test for these heroin users, and then asked them to rate which drug they liked best. And at the end, what they found was that the results were that the heroin users pretty much liked all of the drugs. There weren't that many differences, but if one drug won, it was oxycodone that appeared to be slightly favored over heroin for having some less negative side effects. So they had less itchiness or less sedation with the oxycodone. It had less side effects, which is what you might expect from a designer version of heroin.
Right, kind of like a designer version of cocaine was the pharmaceutical grade cocaine, and a lot of people talked about that. It was almost the Bigfoot sighting back in the 70s was pharmaceutical grade cocaine was talked about, and nobody actually ever saw it, but now you've got the pharmaceutical grade heroin is really the oxycontin or the oxycodone.
That's right. Or you, yes. Well, and another thing people don't realize is that heroin was a prescription drug. It was made by the Bayer Corporation in the late 1800s, and was very popular in the early 1900s. People were buying heroin pills, crushing them, and snorting them. And the heroin problem got so bad in the early 1900s. That it led to a ban on that particular opioid. To this day, people will think of heroin as being more addictive or more dangerous than oxycodone or hydrocodone. The reality is that they are almost the identical molecule. They're really all the same drug.
And that is argued about a lot. You know, we're coming up on a break, and let's talk more about that. And let's talk about when heroin was legal and how this whole epidemic got started when we come back from the break. I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Kolodny, probably the leading expert on opiate addiction in the United States. And you're listening to us here on Afflicted by Addiction. We're coming up on a break. Visit us at rxdrugaddict.com, and please stay with us. We'll be right back.
News. Opinion. Your voice counts. Call toll free 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787. VoiceAmerica.com.
Bradley DeHaven has spoken to thousands of parents and addicts, discovering commonalities and teachable moments that can spare you the consequences of addiction. The signs, symptoms, and solutions of drug addiction is something you can learn now or when you are forced to. Bradley has written two books on drug addiction from the view of a parent. His no BS approach could save your child's life. Brad has been interviewed on Fox, ABC, CBS, The Huffington Post, and other forms of media. Brad and his son appear in the award-winning documentary Behind the Orange Curtain. Brad's available as a keynote speaker for events and corporations. Learning about addiction is important for every family. All the rules have changed, and now the drugs that addict our children are synthetic heroin, prescribed by your doctor and found in your own medicine cabinet. Sign up for Brad's newsletter on rxdrugaddict.com and find links to his two books, Defining Moments and The Addict Among Us. Again, be sure to visit rxdrugaddict.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Bradley DeHaven, and I'm the host of Afflicted by Addiction. The best rehab is the one that works for you. And this show has been made possible by the generous contribution of the rehab center that my son went to, Narcanon. I'm blessed that my son is 2.5 years clean of the drugs that once owned him. Narcanon gave him the tools that he needed to walk through a world filled with drugs and not return to the darkness of addiction. Narcanon did not want to run a commercial during this program, but I want to thank them for allowing the voice of those of you who are afflicted by addiction to be heard. Visit my website, rxdrugaddict.com, to get a link to Narcanon. And if you want to learn more, just click on the site. Again, the best rehab is the one that works for you. Most importantly, seek professional help if you are afflicted by addiction.
Prescription drug and heroin use are epidemic in America. Every 19 minutes, someone dies from a drug overdose. Every 24 minutes, someone dies from a prescription drug overdose. Where do these drugs come from? Your own medicine cabinet, the middle school playground, friends, and the biggest problem of all, dirty doctors. Behind the Orange Curtain is a hard-hitting documentary that will open your eyes and your heart to this very real epidemic facing our youth today. Prescription drugs and heroin use. Addiction crosses all socio and economic barriers. It doesn't matter if you live on Park Avenue or the park bench. No one is exempt. It's in your city, your county, your state, and in your backyard. Behind the Orange Curtain is coming to iTunes April 23rd. Check out Behind the Orange Curtain on Facebook and visit our website at www.behindtheorangecurtain.net.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Afflicted by Addiction with your host, Bradley DeHaven. If you have a question or comment for Brad about the program, please send an email to brad@rxdrugaddict.com. That's brad@rxdrugaddict.com. Now back to our program, Afflicted by Addiction.
Welcome back to Afflicted by Addiction. I'm your host, Bradley DeHaven, and I'm joined today by Dr. Andrew Kolodny, again, probably the leading expert on opiate addiction in the United States, and what a pleasure to have him on the show. Welcome back, Doctor.
Thank you.
So before we left at the break, you kind of alluded to what, you were telling us about when heroin was legal, and you said the Bayer Corporation. Would that be the same Bayer Aspirin Corporation that's in existence today?
That's correct. In fact, Bayer created aspirin a few years after they came up with heroin. And historians who have studied the heroin epidemic in the early 1900s and have theorized as to why that epidemic was brought under control and why we didn't have another heroin problem until the 1970s, one of the theories was that Bayer came out with aspirin or shortly after heroin, and that when they introduced aspirin, that for the first time you had an effective alternative to heroin or morphine and other opioids that were being misused or overprescribed, so that if you think about it, in the early 1900s, if someone had pain or diarrhea or cough, about one of the only remedies that they could get at a pharmacy that would be effective would have been an opioid product. And so when Bayer introduced aspirin, you now had an opportunity for people to have a non-addictive treatment for their pain. And that's one of the theories as to why we were able to bring the opioid epidemic in the early 1900s under control.
So let me ask you something. I'll make a kind of a statement and an observation here. Recently, some of the parents that I know and people that I know were asked to be on the Katie Couric show. And when they got there, at the end of the day, once they interviewed everybody and vetted everybody at the show, they decided to really just bring the people on the show whose kids had died or overdosed on heroin, and they really kind of skipped past the people that had died or overdosed on a prescription drug. My theory on this is much like the days of Big Tobacco, when you could advertise Big Tobacco. We really never heard about the secret memos and the highly addictive nicotine and the things that were being produced to addict thousands of people. And I think now with drugs being, when they're able to advertise drugs in the United States, I think some of these big stations don't want to throw a rock at their biggest, you know, I mean, you can't turn on a TV without seeing a drug commercial in 30 seconds. And I just think that they're reluctant to toss that rock at some of their biggest clients. Do you have any thoughts on advertising and drugs and what effect it might have on citizens of this country finding out the truth about the addictive nature of these drugs?
Yeah, what you're telling me is concerning. I suppose it's possible they thought that a story on heroin would be more sensational or more interesting to their viewers. I mean, if you want to give them the benefit of the doubt. But if you're right, if they didn't want to risk losing corporate sponsors from pharmaceutical companies by focusing on painkiller deaths, that is very disturbing. I do believe that one of the reasons that we've had a great deal of difficulty bringing this epidemic under control, and in fact, I think even the cause of the epidemic in many ways was related to influence by manufacturers of these medications that have profited enormously by their overprescribing.
Well, what do you think, speaking of them profiting and them getting these drugs to where they are legally sellable, they go through the FDA. And when you go through the FDA, and you and I met at an FDA hearing for the first time for Zohydro and Zogenix, the company, and I was really confused at this FDA hearing. It was my first hearing that I'd been to, because it seemed to me that the person hard selling the drug the most ended up being an FDA doctor member. And I was a little surprised at that, because I thought the guy was a lobbyist or a salesman or a representative of Zogenix, but in fact it was Dr. Rappaport, who is a member of the FDA panel, and I was a little surprised at his aggressive nature of pushing this particular drug. It seemed almost like he was daring these people, this panel of doctors, not to approve this, because there were other drugs like that already approved. I mean, this FDA system confuses me. Ken, what can you tell our listeners about the FDA system? Because I'm confused that the day we were there, they voted down Zohydro 11-2 with one abstain, and it's still sitting there waiting for the FDA to actually act on that vote, and they can override that.
Yeah, well, I guess the first thing I would say is that I believe that there are many individuals who work within FDA who take the mission of their agency very seriously, and they're government employees who believe that the FDA needs to protect the public by regulating manufacturers of drugs and foods and other products to keep foods and drugs safe. But there are problems with FDA. One problem is that, at least with the drug approval process, several years ago, there was an idea that the manufacturers of drugs should be footing the bill for a review of their products when they need to be approved. And I think it made sense to the legislators who were deciding that FDA should receive a significant portion of its budget from the companies that it's regulating. You know, it sort of makes sense. Well, why should the taxpayer pay to do this? Why not make the company pay to do this, to be regulated? The problem is that what happens when you create a situation where the manufacturers of products who want to get products released on the market are paying the regulator that's supposed to review their application, it creates a dynamic where the FDA becomes in the position of offering customer service to the very corporations that they're supposed to be regulating. And I think there are problems with the way in which FDA gets is funded that are a conflict of interest. You mentioned Bob Rappaport. Bob Rappaport is the head of the analgesic division of FDA. He's been in that role, I believe, for about a decade. And during the period of time in which there has been an exponential increase in prescribing of opioids, particularly for chronic non-cancer pain, and there are many who believe, and I would put myself in their ranks, that Dr. Rappaport has not done a very good job and has been much too close to industry and to academics who work for industry and hasn't done his job properly. And you know, I think there are directors of other divisions of FDA who really do take their job much more seriously and who don't want to see products approved when the risks of those products may exceed the benefits. And unfortunately, I think the head of the analgesic division, had we had someone who understood the FDA's role and was not really working for industry but for the public's health, I think we'd possibly be in a different place with this epidemic today.
Right, and I'm confused by a lot of his argument was based on, hey, these kind of drugs are already out here, so you can't really say no to these people, because we already said yes to these other people that make, you know, all these other drugs that have addicted and killed tens of thousands of people. It just seemed to me like, you know, the FDA, if you get a bad bag of spinach and somebody gets sick, they start yanking this stuff off the shelves. But here we had OxyContin, which was killing tens of thousands of people and addicting them and being marketed under false pretenses. And it took years to even rein it into where they made a tamper-resistant coating on it so it couldn't be crushed and snorted like you described original heroin was being done, or shot or injected. And obviously OxyContin was being consumed that way too. I know many of the addicts that I've interviewed, that's exactly what they do, is they crush it, snort it, smoke it, or shoot it. And here you've got a drug out there that comes back in, like Zogenix introduced Zohydro, which was no tamper resistance. In fact, the president or somebody, one representative of the company, said that their tamper resistant plan was to put it in childproof containers. So to me, I haven't met or interviewed a drug addict that couldn't open a childproof container. Have you?
No, that really is not can't really call that tamper resistance.
Yeah. And so when they've come so far, and even Dr. Throckmorton, who's also on the FDA, kind of poo-pooed the thought of tamper resistance, and that it, well, there was really no, you know, it wasn't a cure-all, as was his exact words, I believe, to people abusing this drug. But to me, I often use the examples of seatbelts weren't a cure-all, but they saved a lot of lives. But it seems like the FDA kind of just poo-poos anything that throws a cog in the wheel of Big Pharma.
That's right. Well, you know, I agree with most of what you've just said. In fact, there's a lot that FDA could be doing. The FDA could be requiring that every opioid analgesic on the market has some type of tamper resistance built into it. And the reality is that the tamper resistance doesn't have to be some fancy new technology that you can get a patent on. There are some very simple measures that could be taken. For example, if a pill is kept in a low enough dosage and has enough filler added to it, like cornstarch, that pill then becomes very difficult for somebody to snort or inject. If you can think about the lower doses of Vicodin or Percocet, the higher doses of Vicodin and Percocet, people can crush and snort. But the lower doses, where the ratio of the active drug to filler is low enough, these are pills that are not very popular for sniffing, because there's going to be so much junk that's going to go into someone's nose, and similarly, they're not popular to inject. And that wouldn't really cost much. Another thing the FDA could do, which would probably be even more helpful than tamper resistance, would be to put limits on the amount of opioid that can be packed into a single pill. If you look at what experts in the field of pain and epidemiologists and people, researchers, are saying, they're saying that doses of an opioid greater than the equivalent of 100 milligrams of morphine in a single day are very high and not appropriate for patients, that there are very few patients who should be on what they're calling high-dose opioid therapy. But we have pills on the market that have so much opioid in them that even if they're taken exactly as prescribed, that patient is going to be on what experts call high-dose opioid therapy. So just to give you an example, a person who is taking 80 milligram OxyContins, and in fact there was a 160 milligram pill, but a person who's on an 80 milligram dose of OxyContin, that would be prescribed twice a day. And that's 160 milligrams of oxycodone in that OxyContin pill. And that 160 milligrams is the equivalent of about 240 milligrams of morphine.
Wow.
The experts are saying patients shouldn't really be on more than 100 milligrams of morphine in a single day. So why do we need pills like that at all on the market? And if you simply took pills like that off the market, you would be able to reduce many overdose deaths.
Well, let's talk about those pills. So you've got these opiate pills for pain. Is there any real proof? Do they cure pain?
The opioid analysts, by the way, just to clarify, you know, I'm suggesting that the very high dosage pills could be removed from the market,
right.
But we can't remove opioids from the market because they do have serve an important role. So, for example, if someone has just had major surgery, they may need an opioid when they've come out of surgery, something like morphine, for example. And there are also important uses for opioids to ease suffering in palliative care situations, the end of life, and situations where you don't have to worry so much about addiction or worry so much about the fact that people develop a tolerance to opioids and will need higher and higher doses. You may not need to worry because you're using it for someone who's at the end of their life,
right,
where the goal really is to just make them comfortable. But if you look at where the bulk of the opioid prescribing is occurring, and when I'm talking about the consumption of opioids in terms of equivalence of morphine, the majority of the morphine equivalents in the United States, the bulk of the consumption of opioids, are consumed by patients who have a presumptive diagnosis of chronic non-cancer pain. And about 90% of these people with non-cancer pain have low back pain, fibromyalgia, and headache. And when
right.
I say low back pain, not even with real disc disease, but what we would call non-structural low back pain, meaning a fairly healthy back. So that's where the bulk of the prescribing is occurring. And the best available evidence is that when you treat these types of chronic pain with long-term opioids and high doses of opioids, that you're harming far more patients than you're helping. Even the patients that don't lose control of their use will have a very difficult time ever coming off of the opioids. Some wind up stuck on opioids for the rest of their lives. And this is despite the fact that many of them don't get good pain relief, have a decline in the quality of their life because of the effects of the opioid, yet they're stuck on them. Barry Meyer, who I think you may be speaking with soon, reporter for the New York Times, who has written on this before, just came out with a terrific book. I think it's called The World of Hurt, Pain Medicine's Biggest Mistake, in which he talks about how this movement to encourage aggressive prescribing of opioids for chronic common conditions isn't helping patients and has led to a public health crisis.
All right, and Barry Meyer is on my list. We've been exchanging emails, so I'm hoping to tie him down. So I think what I hear you saying is, and I agree with you, is that when doctors are prescribing this to a kid with a broken arm, for instance, or a pulled back in an adult or whatever the case may be, they really don't have an exit plan. But when you're prescribing it to somebody who's terminally ill, you don't really need an exit plan.
Right. Right.
And so coming off of these drugs becomes a real issue if you're prescribing them to somebody, but they are so openly marketed to people with, in my opinion, minor pain and what have you. And I'm with you. I don't think this needs to be removed. You know, I've shared this story before, but I have a wife that was actually in a car accident where she was run down by someone who was high on their prescription meds. But now my wife, after 14 back surgeries, is dependent on pain pills occasionally. So it's not like people like me are trying to take the pain pills out of people's hand. Like Avi Israel said, people with pain have a pill for their pain. Avi buried his son. He said, there's no pill for my pain. And I think that that's really important for people to understand that this is such a slippery slope. And we are coming up on a break, Dr. Kolodny, and we'll come right back and we'll talk a little bit more about the details of opioids. And we're joined by Dr. Andrew Kolodny. I'm Bradley DeHaven, your host on Afflicted by Addiction. We'll be right back after the break.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Hi, I'm Bradley DeHaven, and I'm the host of Afflicted by Addiction. The best rehab is the one that works for you. And this show has been made possible by the generous contribution of the rehab center that my son went to, Narcanon. I'm blessed that my son is 2.5 years clean of the drugs that once owned him. Narcanon gave him the tools that he needed to walk through a world filled with drugs and not return to the darkness of addiction. Narcanon did not want to run a commercial during this program, but I want to thank them for allowing the voice of those of you who are afflicted by addiction to be heard. Visit my website, rxdrugaddict.com, to get a link to Narcanon. And if you want to learn more, just click on the site. Again, the best rehab is the one that works for you. Most importantly, seek professional help if you are afflicted by addiction.
Prescription drug and heroin use are epidemic in America. Every 19 minutes, someone dies from a drug overdose. Every 24 minutes, someone dies from a prescription drug overdose. Where do these drugs come from? Your own medicine cabinet, the middle school playground, friends, and the biggest problem of all, dirty doctors. Behind the Orange Curtain is a hard-hitting documentary that will open your eyes and your heart to this very real epidemic facing our youth today. Prescription drugs and heroin use. Addiction crosses all socio and economic barriers. It doesn't matter if you live on Park Avenue or the park bench. No one is exempt. It's in your city, your county, your state, and in your backyard. Behind the Orange Curtain is coming to iTunes April 23rd. Check out Behind the Orange Curtain on Facebook and visit our website at www.behindtheorangecurtain.net.
Bradley DeHaven has spoken to thousands of parents and addicts, discovering commonalities and teachable moments that can spare you the consequences of addiction. The signs, symptoms, and solutions of drug addiction is something you can learn now or when you are forced to. Bradley has written 2 books on drug addiction from the view of a parent. His no BS approach could save your child's life. Brad has been interviewed on Fox, ABC, CBS, The Huffington Post, and other forms of media. Brad and his son appear in the award-winning documentary Behind the Orange Curtain. Brad's available as a keynote speaker for events and corporations. Learning about addiction is important for every family. All the rules have changed, and now the drugs that addict our children are synthetic heroin, prescribed by your doctor and found in your own medicine cabinet. Sign up for Brad's newsletter on rxdrugaddict.com and find links to his 2 books, Defining Moments and The Addict Among Us. Again, be sure to visit rxdrugaddict.com for more information.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Afflicted by Addiction with your host, Bradley DeHaven. If you have a question or comment for Brad about the program, please send an email to brad@rxdrugaddict.com. That's brad@rxdrugaddict.com. Now back to our program, Afflicted by Addiction.
Welcome back. I'm Bradley DeHaven. I'm your host on Afflicted by Addiction. We are joined by Dr. Andrew Kolodny today, probably this nation's leading expert on opiate addiction and opioid addiction. And we're having a great conversation here. We're going to continue that conversation. Welcome back, doctor.
Thank you.
Just a reminder to my listeners, you can visit my website on rxdrugaddict.com, and on Facebook, you can like us at Afflicted by Addiction, the title of the show, and join us there for comments and show updates. So, Dr. Kolodny, I would like to ask you kind of an all-encompassing question that we can expand on, and what do you think caused this epidemic, which, you know, few people are calling it, but the CDC is calling it. But what do you think caused this epidemic of opiate addiction and overdose deaths?
That's a great question. So the CDC tried to answer that question, and I think they came up with a very good explanation about why are we seeing so many overdose deaths from painkillers today, and what's caused this increase. And to answer that question, Len Palazzi, who is a medical director in the Injury Prevention Center at the CDC, did an interesting study, I think it was in 2007, where he took a graph and he charted out over time on that graph number of people dying from painkiller overdoses. And what you saw was a line that just sort of started to shoot up beginning in the late 1990s to the present, really demonstrating maybe a 400% increase in people dying of overdoses from painkillers. And on the same graph, what he then drew plotted out over time consumption of opioids in the United States. He took all of the different opioids that were prescribed, oxycodone, morphine, hydrocodone, was able to get this data from the Drug Enforcement Administration, and was able to convert it all into the equivalence of morphine. And so he plotted out over time the amount of opioids being consumed in the United States. And what you had at the end of this experiment was these two lines on this graph that showed an identical parallel increase. And what Dr. Palazzi argued in this paper was that this epidemic of overdose deaths has been caused by increases in the prescribing of opioids. And later on, just a couple of years ago, the FDA repeated that study, but this time they added a third line for addiction, rates of addiction, people seeking treatment for painkiller addiction, and all three lines went up in parallel. And so the CDC has been saying that the epidemic we have today was this epidemic of both addiction to painkillers and overdose deaths from painkillers has been caused by a change in physician prescribing practices that beginning in the late 1990s, as doctors began to prescribe painkillers far more aggressively than they ever had before. It's that increase in prescribing, that change in practice, that has led to this epidemic.
So, change in prescribing practice, what do you think is the root of this movement that doctors are prescribing so many more painkillers?
That's another great question. So if it was a change in practice, what caused that change in practice that led to the epidemic? I think the answer to that question would be a brilliant marketing campaign that was conducted by Purdue Pharma. So Purdue Pharma introduced OxyContin in the late 1990s. It was actually around 1996 that they first introduced OxyContin. And when they were introducing OxyContin, it was a time when the medical community understood well that treating common chronic conditions like low back pain or headache with long-term opioids was a bad idea. The medical community understood that painkillers are addictive and that you can develop tolerance to the analgesic effects, meaning you'd need higher and higher doses, and that they're dangerous. People could easily overdose on them. So the medical community was prescribing more reasonably. But at that time that Purdue was introducing OxyContin, they had another long-acting opioid on the market, which was MS-Contin. That medicine was being prescribed appropriately for people at the end of life with cancer pain. And so Purdue, and what I'm about to tell you, we know from documents that became available through legal challenges against Purdue, recognized that if they were going to do well with this product, they needed to make sure that it would be prescribed beyond just people who have pain at the end of life with cancer. For one thing, there aren't that many people at the very end of life with cancer pain, and they won't be on your product for very long if they're at the end of life. But if you could get the medical community, if you could get doctors to use your product for common chronic conditions that people will suffer for a long period of time, then you've got a product that you can make a lot of money with. And so they conducted a campaign to convince the medical community that they shouldn't be worrying about getting patients addicted. They misused data, and in fact, they paid physicians who were prominent in the field of pain to give lectures convincing doctors that the compassionate way to treat people with any kind of pain was to prescribe opioids aggressively, and that if a doctor was withholding opioids or reluctant to prescribe because of fear of addiction, well, they had a term for that. They called it opiophobia, meaning that the doctors had an unrealistic fear of getting their patients addicted. And so that led, I think, to the change in practice. You had professional societies who adopted, who were part of the campaign to encourage prescribing. And as practices changed, you then had other pharmaceutical companies begin to manufacture opioids to get in on this new market and this new practice. And so the medical community was misled to believe that the compassionate way to treat anyone who complains of pain is to prescribe a highly addictive drug in an aggressive fashion.
So it's almost as if it was, and I've talked to a lot of doctors about this, they felt like their training and their practice led them to believe that it was basically their duty to treat pain, and if they needed to err on the side of caution, they would treat pain, as opposed to erring on the side of caution and not panning out the opioids.
That's correct. The docs were taught, and many may still believe, that you should never withhold an opioid from a patient because you're worried about them getting addicted, or you're worried even that they might be selling it or misusing it, that pain is what the patient tells you it is, and that you should always believe your patient. And even if you suspect that the patient may be addicted or may be selling the drugs, that you should just trust your patient and prescribe away.
Right. And we talked a lot about addiction and death and opioids. But there's more to this than addiction and death. There's babies being born every hour that are addicted to opioids now. So they used to talk about crack babies, but now it's opioid babies. And there's the admission to emergency rooms has gone off the charts. And I think it would probably follow your same chart as far as the prescribing practice. But Los Angeles County, one of the counties down there, or one of the hospitals down there, reported that about 50% of their hospital emergency room admissions were from drug overdose or some reaction to a prescription drug.
That's correct. So the trends I mentioned, the trend in increases in addiction, increases in overdose deaths, you will see the exact same trend for many different phenomena, like babies born with what we call neonatal abstinence syndrome. They're born dependent on opioids, and they need to be tapered at the beginning of life. These are infants that are very uncomfortable at birth, and many of them wind up stuck in the hospital for up to a month. It appears that some will have behavioral problems going forward, congenital heart defects. So you have the next generation being damaged by this epidemic. But yes, you can also see a trend, the same trend, in visits to emergency rooms associated with use of painkillers, and just many different ways of looking at this problem. You see the same trend, that it begins in the late 90s, early 2000s, and just continues to get worse after that.
So let's talk a little bit about what can be done to control this epidemic. Let's talk a little bit about reform. I'm going to use my analogy again with the car and the seatbelts. I mean, I think there was a day when cars first came out and they did 4 miles an hour. We didn't really have a need for seatbelts, but then they started doing 150 miles an hour, and suddenly we started seeing people get, you know, hurt, and the need for seatbelts was in there, and it saved a lot of lives. So the same with drugs, I think, in that you start to see that chart go up and all these opiates going out there in the street and all these people becoming addicted and ending up in the emergency room and giving birth to these babies. What reforms do you think are needed now with this change of environment and the availability of all of these drugs that are highly addictive and deadly? That what top reforms do you see would help curb this epidemic?
Right. Well, I think the bulk of people who are dying of overdoses are addicted to painkillers, as I explained. Not everyone, although the strategies to address the addiction problem would be helpful to people who are dying who are not addicted as well. But, you know, because the bulk of the people who are dying of overdoses appear to have this disease of addiction, I think the right way to think about bringing this problem under control is to think about controlling this epidemic the way we would control any other disease epidemic, whether it was an HIV epidemic or a flu epidemic. What you have to do to control an epidemic is prevent people from getting the disease and see that people who have the disease have access to effective treatment. You have to do both. So, for example, if we were to simply curtail aggressive overprescribing in an effort to prevent people from getting addicted, well, if you don't see that there's access to effective treatment for the people who have the disease, as we talked about earlier, the heroin markets are just going to flourish. So you really have to do both. You have to see that people have access to effective treatment, and you have to prevent people from getting addicted. I think the more urgent issue, perhaps, might be prevention. And one of the most effective things that we can do to prevent people from getting addicted in the first place is to make sure that the medical community understands the risks and benefits of opioids. And one way to do that would be to better regulate the claims that opioid manufacturers are making about their products to doctors. Right now, the FDA is allowing pharmaceutical companies to tell doctors that long-term opioids are safe and effective for every moderate to severely painful condition under the sun. And it's very difficult to get better information about risks and benefits to doctors so that they understand that opioids are addictive and that they don't work well long-term. It's hard to get that information out when you have drug companies advertising these products as safe and effective. So one thing that could be very helpful would be if the FDA were to simply enforce an existing law called the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. That law says that a drug company is not allowed to promote a product for a condition where that product has not yet been proven safe and effective. That's called off-label marketing, and it's illegal. And that's all linked to a drug's labeled indication. If opioid manufacturers were limited on their label to an indication where the benefits are more likely to outweigh risks, for example, pain at the end of life or cautious use short-term for severe pain, and not allowed to advertise for all of the common chronic conditions, that would reduce some of the aggressive over-prescribing. And it's not just for chronic pain, but we have a situation where because even dentists may not understand that a Vicodin is really a heroin pill in many regards, that you know they'll give a teenager 30 pills when that teenager may have only needed one or two. Right. Maybe that teenager didn't even need one or two. Maybe Advil would have been a better choice.
Right.
And you've got doctors who really don't recognize that these are heroin pills.
Well, and I think you're right. I think a lot of what we do in reform is kind of like building a dam way downriver when we've got to go back upriver and figure out where this stuff is flowing from and get the education level there. I know we're coming up on a hard close in the end of the show. Dr. Kolodny, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I could do a two-hour show with you in a heartbeat and fill every second of it. Any final 15-second words that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I just want to thank you for the opportunity and tell you to keep up the great work.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kolodny. I would like to thank my listeners for being there. We're on every Tuesday at noon. This is Bradley DeHaven. You've been listening to Afflicted by Addiction, and we'll be here every Tuesday at noon. And thank you so much for listening. And Dr. Kolodny, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for tuning in this week. Please join Bradley DeHaven for another Afflicted by Addiction program on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll be back next Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time. We'll talk more then.